Dorothy Ackerman, who is Friends General Conference Field Secretary for North Central Continent, I will say, and who is a member of the Twin City monthly meeting, will introduce Mulford Sibley.
For those of you who are not aware, Twin Cities in our part of the world means Minneapolis, St. Paul. When I was in Japan, I found some precious things which were labeled national treasures. And tonight, I'm proud to share with you one of our Quaker treasures, one which those of you in other parts of the country have not been able to share with us. When Mulford has spoken to friends in our meeting, in our yearly meeting, on what I believe, I have never been able to get into the room. It was wall-to-wall friends and down the hall and down the stairs. He has been teaching as a university professor and retired, what?
A year ago?
Retired a year ago, and at the University of Minnesota, there was a week of celebrations in his honor, the like of which I have not seen. It was quite a performance. There was one session that many of us went to where they read to him and asked him some of the questions that he had asked his doctoral candidates. As I remember, one of them is, what is the sociological implications of the hamburger? He prefers to be remembered as a teacher, although he has written quite a few books, and he has taught in quite a few areas related to social science and American studies. He has done something which I think is also very unusual. He has gone so far as to share with students a very personal interest in psychic phenomena and has taught university courses in that area also. He has also published in that area. In the Twin Cities, he is known as a leader in demonstrations. His wife told me one time that if there was an anti-war demonstration and Mulford was out of town, she took the phone off the hook, because if he wasn't there, the phone would ring constantly. Where is Mulford? We want Mulford to speak to us. Where is Mulford? For this purpose, she made him a red necktie. He doesn't have it on tonight. Likewise, as you can understand the symbolism of the red necktie, he has been taken for a communist more than once. One time when he was going to Canada to address a women's peace organization, he was stopped at the border and asked his name and so on, and then they said, "Are you a communist?" And he refused to answer. And he said, Are you friends with communists?" And he refused to answer. So they gave him a choice of going to jail or being sent back at their expense on a plane. So he came back. He never got to make that speech. There also was a time when he and another university professor were attacked as being communists, and I have never seen such an outpouring of support in the local press, in the letters to the editor, by people of every political persuasion who say, "I may not agree with him now, but complete support for this favorite teacher, for this one who was such a wonderful mentor of their youth." He was somewhat depressed at the time of his retirement at the idea of ending a career, whereupon he promptly started teaching jurisprudence at the William Mitchell School of Law. He and Marjorie had planned to spend the week with us here, but because he's now teaching summer school, he has to go home tomorrow morning. My favorite Mulford story, I may not have it quite right, but I'll give you the essence of it, was told me by someone who was with him in an elevator one day, around the time when he was being attacked for being a communist, and they were trying to throw him out. Some people were wanting him to be thrown out of the U. And he spoke to another person in the elevator, a woman. After they got out, his friend said to him, "But that's the woman that's trying to get you thrown out of the university. That's the woman who's accusing you." And Mulford's answer was, "But she's lonely. She hasn't any friends. That's why she does that." I think that is a Quakerly answer we can all be proud of. His middle name starts with a Q, and we all think it stands for Quaker. So I give you Mulford Quaker Sibley.
Thank you, Dorothy, and I'm sorry about the hellish state of the atmosphere here this evening, the physical atmosphere, that is. I think I do derive some comfort from the fact that we're more like hell than heaven here because of the physical atmosphere. The most interesting utopias are those which portray evil places and not those which portray good places. I'm not quite sure, but that will be one of the points in my talk this evening, that in developing visions, we develop visions both of good and of evil, just what the two sides imply, and that strangely enough, the dullest portrayals often are of heaven. I think any of you who are familiar with Dante's trilogy will agree, for example, that his portrayal of hell is much more interesting and vital than his portrayal of heaven or perhaps of purgatory, although purgatory is more interesting than heaven. Why is that true? Well, I hope you'll give me the answer. In the discussion period, too, I should like to say that if any of you are interested in psychical phenomena, I'd be glad to get into that area a little bit also, although presumably most of the discussion will center around what I have to say. Because of the heat, I shall not object if you leave the room, although I don't wish to invite you to. About 50 years ago, G.H.C. McGregor, a Scottish scholar, wrote a little volume called The Relevance of an Impossible Ideal. It was a criticism of Reinhold Niebuhr's outlook, particularly as reflected in his book, Moral Man and Immoral Society. McGregor argued that impossible ideals, as Niebuhr viewed them, had a role to play in human existence, and he tried to spell out that role. Nevertheless, Niebuhr persisted in his attack on utopian visions. Thus, for him, the fascists had to be condemned because they sought to impose a structure on society by force. Hence, fascists were termed by him hard utopians. But Niebuhr was almost equally harsh on Quakers. They were what he called soft utopians because they were under the illusion that through gentleness and love and without coercion, an ideal society could be ushered in. They emphasized love at the expense of justice, and justice might require force, so Niebuhr thought. Men like Tillich differed with Niebuhr, of course, and argued that love and power and justice are interrelated. They're not in tension, or ought not to be rightly understood. Although pushing his proposition about Quakers too far, there may be a kernel of truth in what Niebuhr implied. Critics have spoken with some justification of Quaker vagueness, particularly about power, for example. Without agreeing with everything they have said, we can grant that their criticism makes a valid point. We Quakers are sometimes loath to try to translate general feelings of goodwill into the more concrete and holistic visions of what ought to be. Partly justifiable in the fear, or partly supported perhaps in the fear that explicit visions might lead to dogma, or God forbid, some involved theology or ideology. We are legitimately fearful of those things, I suggest, but perhaps we push our fear too far. But while we should keep ourselves flexible and open to new insights, we should also attempt, it seems to me, to spell out more precisely what a Quaker-inspired society might be like. We should, in short, spin utopias that attempt to grapple with the enormous problems of our day. A utopia is a literary presentation of an ideal society, or as the word utopia means, it was coined by St. Sir Thomas More, a good no place. Dystopia, a word coined in the 20th century, means a bad place. You keep those two terms in mind, then what I have to say may make a little bit more sense than I'm afraid it does. Both utopia and dystopia have their roots in the everyday world around us. We live in a universe of mixed good and evil, and the utopist takes the germs of the good about us and tries to imagine a world in which only the good tendencies exist. A dystopia does just the reverse. It pushes the evil of the world to extremes and admits and omits the good. Both a utopia and a dystopia are efforts to understand things through simplifications and to call attention of evil and call attention of evil better if we see it unclothed, as it were. And so it is with good. We can understand the nature of evil, that is, better if we see it unclothed, and so it is with good. Sharp delineations of what we deem to be good or evil serve to clarify and make pointed our visions. And as the Bible said, without vision, a people perish. Utopia and dystopia provide us with models to guide us, goals around which our actions can be integrated. They are not merely amusing anecdotes, sometimes dull ones, but rather indispensable parts of rational conduct. We cannot act rationally unless we formulate an end, work out means appropriate for the end, and then develop the will to act. Far from being some will-o'-the-wisp, a utopia, implicit or explicit, is inseparable from purposeful human conduct. In order to answer the question, what is the ideal society given traditional Quaker values, I'd like first of all to call attention to the complex division of labor model as a possible answer to our dilemmas. And secondly, to sketch out just the opposite formulation of low-level division of labor as a reaction to the first. Thirdly, to reject both these statements in favor of a third way. That is, to reject both the notion that our ills, social and otherwise, are due to too little integration, too little centralization, and to reject equally the opposite position. But before that, I'd like to state the positions, you see. So we reject both these statements in the third part of my comments, and fourthly, then, examine the challenges that await us as we seek to implement the utopian ideal. So there are four major points in my comments. First, to call attention to one diagnosis of the problem, which is the centralization notion. Secondly, to sketch out the opposite formulation of the problem. Thirdly, to reject both these statements in favor of a third way. and finally to examine some of the important challenges that await us as we seek to implement the utopian ideal. If amidst this heat you can keep in mind 4 points, I'd appreciate it. The first kind of vision sees the moral and political problem of humanity as arising out of too little integration, too little technology, too little division of labor, and not enough planning. In visions of the 19th and 20th centuries, injustice is seen to lie in the hit-or-miss way in which things are done, technologies introduced, and economies allowed to go their own ways without much overall planning. The remedy, according to this view, then, is more centralization, more integration, much more social and political planning. Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward and H.G. Wells' A Modern Utopia may be said to exemplify this first response to the human problem. For Bellamy, the capitalist society of his time, with its laissez-faire economy, its absence of planning for social ends, its gross disparities in income, and its sheer lack of ardor, was something to be repelled with horror. Production and distribution must be planned, and equalization of wealth and power be attained. Every person is to receive the same amount of credit, which must be used by the end of the year. Thus, you can't accumulate huge amounts for private fortunes. Retirement comes at 45, which also begins the activity of all in the political world. In other words, from the early 20s to 45, one is an economic animal, producing and distributing. And after 45, a political one, devoting virtually full time to making decisions for the community. This highly planned economy accepts almost without question the introduction of complex machinery. Technology can do no wrong. One can say that in Bellamy we have highly epitomized the wholehearted acceptance of technology as a good. There is little of the skepticism about man's use of tools, which one will find in such writers as Mary Shelley, who in Frankenstein imagines a monster created by human beings. In Wells, we have a similar utopian vision, but it's a world vision. The political society is a world state with a large measure of state planning, a highly trained ruling class, an elaborate system for keeping track of people, which is part of the general planning scheme. Thus, there's a central index in Paris which records the activities of every person on Earth. You can look at this index in something like this, I guess. I imagine it looks something like that. And look up under Schmidt Hugo and find exactly where he is at any hour of the day. While there is said to be great diversity as between classes, yet at times it seems to be a bit superficial. Like Bellamy, Wells is rebelling against what both see as the chaotic planlessness of so many societies, with periodic depressions, inflation, and disregard of human values. Those characteristics, I might add, still persist, even though Bellamy wrote his book back in the 1880s. Only a world state, Wells concludes, of some kind, can remove the curse of war. Well, those are the points, the main points, then, of the first position, you see, utopian position. More integration, more centralization, more complex division of labor, and the problems of planlessness, injustice, and so on, social injustice, will be eliminated. Now we turn to the second response to the problem. The importance of division of labor has been debated from ancient times to the present day. In the early part of Plato's Republic, for example, he outlines the stages of development of division of labor, from very low-level division of labor to intense and complex division of labor. The former he identifies as the simple state, and if possible, it would be the ideal. It is a state going back with few wants and with little complexity. Unfortunately, however, there is within the human being a tendency to want more the more one has. More, 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 Plato argues. Pushed to extremes, this means that we would run out of land to support our expensive habits and would seize a slice of our neighbor's land to satisfy our own wants. And thus is born imperialism. The task of building a just society, Plato thought, was to create a state in which those of low-level appetites for material things were given ruling power. That, at least, was the second best in Plato's position. Plato's discussion of the dangers of complexity is matched by modern literary utopias which seek to portray societies of a primitive nature that avoid the rigidities and stifling effects of highly integrated societies. A good example is William Morris's News from Nowhere. In this agrarian novel, the fundamental revolution is not the alteration of the power structure of an industrial society, typical of liberal and socialist proposed revolutions, but rather the reversal of history through a highly decentralized community in which most technology is very primitive indeed. Most complex technology has been allowed to rust. Parliament has been abolished. It's now occupied by a manure pile. The money no longer exists. Money no longer exists. Division of labor is very simple, as one might expect. Morris's men and women are happy hand-harvesting the crops, living on simple foods, and devoting much of their time to play, discussion, and recreation. Morris rejects the notion so common in our day that a vast expansion of technology is imperative if we are to have enough material goods to sustain human life. Morris's agrarian utopia, or something like it, is echoed in the writings of Tolstoy, and likewise in those of Gandhi and of one of Gandhi's mentors, John Ruskin. Both hope it will be possible to reverse what seem to be the inevitabilities of the modern age and to establish something very much like a Platonic primitive state. Thus, whether in Morris, Tolstoy, or Gandhi, we have the picture of a community in which the degree of interdependence between human beings is drastically altered in the hope that every person's moral autonomy will be enhanced. You see, part of the argument is that the extreme centralization position, the extreme complex division of labor position, leads the individual to be less than a whole person. He is alienated, he or she is alienated from the whole community, and you can't build community on alienated individuals. And Morris argues you need a complete reversal of that tendency. Back to the land, I suppose we would call it, and simplicity in everything. It would be one of the most profound revolutions that one could have, far more than any of the so-called revolutions that have existed in the last 50 years. Morris looked upon the task of vindicating the small decentralized community as an extraordinarily important one. He was a kind of late 19th century Luddite. You all remember the Luddites who early in the 19th century began smashing machines because they were putting them out of work. Of course, if you ask a Luddite, in the long run, the machines will bring abundance. The Luddite might well have applied at that point. It may be true in the long run, but in the short run, I'll be dead. I won't live in the long run. No one lives in the long run, you see. This is the answer to many of the economists in our day who say, in the long run, things will adjust, you see. But in the long run, we're all dead, said Lord Keynes, you see. We have to live in the short run, too. What are we going to do about social justice in the short run is a legitimate question, you see. A great 20th century satirical utopia carries on Morris's criticism while not necessarily subscribing to all the positive features of the 19th century thinker. Let's sample Eugene Zamyatin, Zamyatin, in his dystopia called We. It's primarily a negative critic, a harsh commentator on the tendency of societies of extreme division of labor to encourage alienation and to express, to suppress the individual soul. In the novel, We is portrayed a society whose Adam and Eve had made a decision radically different from that of the human race's first parents when they rebelled against God. Whereas the Adam and Eve of the earthly myth had chosen freedom over security. After all, Eve's first bite opened the floodgates of freedom with all its dilemmas. I've never been able quite to understand why the feminist movement hasn't made Eve a heroine, because she started human history. Adam wouldn't have had the courage to take the bite. Eve took the bite at the very beginning, and Adam started to trail along, you see. At any rate, the eating of the apple opened human history with freedom and all its dilemmas. Now, the first parents of Zamyatin's novel, the Adam and Eve of Zamyatin's novel, had opted for security and rejected freedom. Freedom was ugly. The result could be foreseen. The whole history of the United States of We is the story of men and women searching for the exactitude of the multiplication tables in human affairs. They wanted everything to be as exact as multiplication tables. When I look at some of our technologists today, I think they have that in mind. With security always as the goal, it has not been quite achieved. Everyone eats at the same hour, chews food the same number of times, engages in sexual intercourse only at specified periods, and then only with the authorization of a pink slip, has children only by permission, and then only if he or she fulfills the state-imposed norms as to height, size of bosom, genetic background, and so on. Personal names, of course, have been abolished long ago in the interest of efficiency, record-keeping, and the unity of the United States. Thus, the hero of the novel is called D503, and his surreptitious lover is I-90. I forbear commenting upon the resemblance of this passage to our current situation. I'll let you draw your own conclusions. There is a supreme confidence in technology, and all ties with the external world of crude, hairy human beings who have no security are discouraged. One of the themes of the novel is the continued existence of fancy centers of imagination in the minds and the brains of men and women. As the novel draws to a close, however, the scientists of the United States have worked out a scheme for the removal of the fancy centers from the last few who possess them, including D503. A society of mathematical exactitude and complete security is imminent, and the goals of the United States are about to be fulfilled when the last refuge of individual personality has been wiped out through an operation on the fancy centers of a few dissidents. A satirical utopia such as the great 19th century novel of Samuel Butler called Erewhon emphasizes that utopias like that of Bellamy, above all, have confidence in technology and what it can do for the world. But the Erewhonians will have nothing of this faith in technical progress. Very early they envision a state of the world in which the machines will take over human life and will, in fact, become another species. Just as the human race itself departed from other lines of primates in the remote past, so the machine has all the possibility of making human beings its servants. Already the population of the world is so dependent on advanced technology that to deprive humanity of the machine would perhaps starve a high proportion of men and women. The machines are clever, and implicit in them is the ability to plan for their own independent existence. Before they know it, humans will be completely subordinate to the demands and the imperatives of man-made technology. To prevent this unfortunate event, the Erewhonians just in time established limitations on technological development. They draw the line at the mangle, or the ironer, they'll go that far in technological development beyond the mangle or the ironer, they will not go. Any more complex machines are strictly prohibited. Human society will have intervened to prevent the slavery of humans to technological complexity. There can be little doubt that many of the dystopian and other critics of the integration model are right, even if we don't carry the proposition as far as some of them. If we use the United States as an example, for instance, the imperatives of centralization and technology are evident. Complex division of labor must be coordinated, and this has given rise in American life to giant corporations within the nets of which most of us are caught.